Hello there. Welcome to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. In today's program, we're going to hear local stories from people living local to Oberon. No matter where we live or what our lives have been, everyone has an interesting story to tell. We'll hear from John Martin, now living in Oberon, but who grew up near Dark Corner, Janina Knight, born in Europe, and with a fascinating story to tell about long-lost relatives. And then Grace Cunningham, born and living in Oberon for over 80 years, and she's going to tell us some of Oberon's history. Now, my first guest is John Martin. John now lives in Oberon, but John, his father and his grandfather lived and worked in Emmaville and Dark Corner, working in mining and farming. John, when your grandfather first came to Dark Corner, he was a miner, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a Cornish miner. They referred to him as Cousin Jacks. And they were short, strong, slightly darker skin, and weak in the head like myself.
Now, your grandfather had been working in the mines. What was the state of the mines that he was working in at that time?
This is at Emmaville. Tin just looks like black sand, and some of it is sort of open cut, and then I believe some of it was underground mining. I'm not real familiar with this, but I've read that old river beds or creek beds contain this black sand, and they tunnel in after it. But when we were there, there was enormous areas of open cut stuff, black sand, and apparently, occasionally, you'd get inferior type diamonds in the sand. And then there was a copper mine and different other mines and an arsenic mine. That was quite big in the area. And there was a funny thing about that. Arsenic dust is like miniature barbs and it penetrates your skin. And all the miners used to wear the satin women undergarments.
Oh, right.
Under their clothes. And this was to stop these...
It's very hazardous.
Oh, it was
very hazardous time. Now, there's another mine set up around Dark Corner that had been set up by an Irishman.
Yep, Paddy Leckie Mine.
Tell us the story about Paddy Leckie Mine.
The Paddy Leckie Mine was owned by the Irishman. He was called Patrick Larkey. And everyone that worked in the Paddy Leckie Mine eventually killed him because of the quartz dust, which is just like finely ground glass. In a coal mine, when they get dusted, it blocks off the lung and it's like a paste, where quartz dust is glass and it just keeps cutting. And towards the end, all they're doing is coughing up blood, and that's how grandfather got killed. But when they blast at the end of the tunnel, they were supposed to wait 15 to 20 minutes for the dust to settle. And they were on contract and they used to go in before the dust had completely settled, and this year they all got dust. When a Paddy Leckie mine started to fail, before that Paddy was crooked and his mates convinced him to go on holiday. When he come back, they were all having a few beers in one of the Sunny Corner hotels. It was 13 hotels in Sunny Corner. Apparently, some say up to 28, but these were regarded as sly grog shops. Yeah. Apparently...
You wouldn't fit 28 hotels at Sunny Corner now.
Well, a sly grog shop could be anything. And apparently the story goes you weren't allowed to take money for selling grog, but as you walked out the door, you left a donation.
Oh, right. See?
And that was legal.
Yeah.
But if you took money with a licence, hotel, you can collect money, but with a sly grog shop, you can't.
So what happened to Paddy?
Well, when he come back from the holiday, they're all having these few drinks, and he dropped dead. So instead of having a few drinks, it then turned into an Irish wake, and they organised a coffin, and they measured the body and wrote it down and got Dry Scott, our great-uncle, or my great-uncle now, and he was only 18 at the time, and he went right down to the other end of Sunny Corner to the undertaker. The undertaker looked at it, and he said, "You've made a mistake. Measure it again." So I come right back through Sunny Corner and told him, he said, the undertaker said, "You've made a mistake, measure it again." And they measured it again and they said, "We're correct. If he doesn't want the job, we'll give it to the other undertaker." It was two in Sunny Corner. It was over 3,000 people in Sunny Corner.
Oh.
Anyhow, they drank all day, and the next morning when the coffin was delivered, it was enormous. And they put Paddy in the coffin. Just before that, someone couldn't believe how well he looked. And his mate said, he said the holiday had done him a lot of good. And there was 2 foot spare in the coffin. And they got the tape out again, and there was 2 foot broke off the end of the tape. So when they went to load it into the hearse, they couldn't close the doors. So it was put in the back of a spring cart, and it hung over the back, and they had a young horse in the spring cart, and the shafts reared up, and Dry was driving the spring cart, and the horse bolted. So they headed it towards Kirkconnell, and he's there ages before the cortege caught up. In those days, they had a headstone and a footstone, and Paddy's grave has got 7'6" coffin.
So your father was also born in Dark Corner?
Our dad was born at Emmaville.
Emmaville,
yes,
okay.
Yes, 1888, the same year as Johnny Walker Whiskey started.
Now, your grandfather had been working in the mine for ages, and we've just heard about how it affected many of the miners. How old was he when he died?
42. Grandfather came down from Emmaville. He got a job at the Homeward Bound mine. He'd bought a 40 acres at Dark Corner. That was block number 2 in the very early days. You grew your own vegetables, you had an orchard. He worked in the Homeward Bound, and he'd leave with clean corduroy trousers. The boys would have to spend the weekend polishing his boots, black Dublin. And
very dapper, was he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he'd walk to work with enough food. He camped on the site and then come home Wednesday night for another lot of food and change of clothes. Go to the mine and they'd lower him down the shaft into 3 foot of water. And that's their work. Well, then when he started at the Paddy Lackey mine, he bought a share. He borrowed £460 to buy a share in the mine. And when the mine started to fail, it was being sold up, and all the machinery was sold, and when they were dismantling, they found the battery, the big stamping battery, where they're pulling it to pieces, was a fault in the sieves. Most of the gold was going out in the sand. Too late then, and grandfather owed this £460, and he taught himself French and got a job at managing a chromium mine in New Caledonia. Uncle Jim and grandfather were over there for 6 years, and when Dad left school, he went over for 18 months, and Dad used to tell a lot of stories. They used to employ the Kanakas. Dad always called them Kanakas. He used to tell a story that they had a contract for carting in these big logs for the mines, and the head man would line up all his men, the tallest in the front, the shortest at the back, and they'd stand either side of these huge logs, and on a command they'd pick it up and then they'd start singing. And Dad said you'd look up the side of these mountains and you'd see this log coming. It looked like an enormous caterpillar, all these legs, and they're singing all the way, and they'd come down to the mine, stop them, and on a command both sides would jump to one side and the log would drop on the ground. Then they go back for another one. And there was a lot of Japanese workers. He had a high regard for the Japanese men. The French convicts, when they finished their time, they never went home. You stayed there. They used to tattoo one another. Occasionally they'd have these competitions, who had the best tattoos. Dad said there one day, they're showing off all these tattoos, and this fella, he didn't have a hair on his body, head or anywhere. And on the back, there was these blokes on horseback. Around the front, there was the hounds. And then he turned around and there was the tail of the fox just sticking out of his rectus.
Work of art. Let's bring the clock forward now and tell us about your father.
When grandfather came back from New Caledonia, he was sick. He and grandfather went to Bathurst and they bought a single furrow plough off Fred Fish and started farming. Grandfather only lived 6 weeks after he came home, and he was dead at 42. Things were really tough in those days. So Dad was 3 years and he left the farm because he didn't have any money. You grew your own vegetables, meat. And he run up a bill with Fraser's store in Sunny Corner for bread. Then he started to work that off. He run the spring cart from sunny corner to Palmer's Oak, delivering groceries and everything from Fraser's store to work off his debt. In those days, a handshake was your contract. You never broke it. You made a deal and shook hands, by geez, you never broke that. With the single furrow plough, he was contract ploughing for Ferguson's down Palmer's Oak for 10 shillings an acre. And you ploughed an acre a day, and that was good money.
Yeah. Why did you decide to take up farming?
Well, Dad was a bee farmer all over the state, and he wanted us to be bee farmers. You work like hell, but you can't see where you've been. And I always liked farming because you work like hell, but you could see what you've done.
Yeah.
And when I started school, it was during the war. The school was closed. No one there. And then we got a teacher. He was a drunk. He had a family. And I was seven before I started school. Sometimes you'd go to school and there'd be no teacher there because he'd be drunk. Then we used to ride our push bikes. When he left, we'd ride our push bikes through to Sunny Corner. That was 10 kilometres. We'd ride in and out 20 kilometres a day. We were fit. I left school at 14 because there was no chance of getting to high school or anything like that in those days. And my high school was a single furrow plough and a five-prong potato fork. We used to dig potatoes by hand. Dad grew potatoes, parsnips, peas, and everything all through the war. And then after he retired and handed the farming over to us, I used to work a five-horse team. We had a three-furrow plough, and we had two shave ploughs, which were reversible disc ploughs. You could plough on the side of a hill, and you threw everything the one way. So you could start at the bottom and just keep working up a hill. Ted and I started growing potatoes together. We put in 15 acres all by hand. We had Christmas dinner in the potato paddock with the horses, and we had a good crop and a good price. But, oh, Jesus, talk about work. And Ted reckoned there was a better way of making a living, and he bought a 1954 Holden car, and he went shearing, working the shearing shed. He wasn't a shearer then, but he worked in the shearing sheds. And Dad made a bet with him that he wouldn't bank anything. Ted made a £10 bet that he would bank £10 a week. When the shearing season was over, he went cutting asparagus, living pretty rough, and he'd come home with yellow jaundice. His eyes were yellow, his skin was yellow, and we nursed him back to health.
So how did he get it?
Bad food.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we nursed him back to health, he's taken off again to the shearing sheds. And Dad reminded him of the debt. He owed Dad £10. And Ted said, I'll pay that. And Dad said, you'll never do any good. We brought you home and nursed you back to health like a fly-blowing sheep, and now he said you're going back to the same thing. But then I was growing potatoes, and digging potatoes by hand, that's hard.
Yeah.
I got a catalogue, and there was this potato digging machine, and I read it and read it and read it and looked at it and looked at it, and I ordered it by phone. And I got word that it came on the railway station, and I had an Oldsmobile truck, and it had a 12-foot tray on the back, and I went in to pick up this potato digger, and it hung over the back. It was that big. I was amazed. I'd never seen one. See, I only saw a picture.
Yeah.
And I had it parked up the street in Bathurst, and I got out of the truck, and I'm looking at it. God, it was a beautiful-looking machine, all this nice red paint and everything. And an old bloke came along and he said, what the hell is that? And I said, it's a potato digger. He said, any fool knows you can't dig potatoes with a machine. Oh, jeez, I'd never seen a machine work. So we had a Caterpillar tractor then, and this nice crop of potatoes. And when I bought it, there was another attachment over the, just behind the digging chair, there was another elevator above it. So you could dig downhill, and this a long chain that helped keep the soil and potatoes on the first chain. So I went 3 feet, everything jammed up. Wasn't going to work. So I pulled this attachment off, and it was the greatest thing we ever had. One year we had 125 acres of potatoes in. We dug 8,000 bags with this machine. It was absolutely unbelievable. We'd have 10 blokes picking up spuds, and we'd have a truckload of potatoes every night to the Sydney markets.
Mm. Yeah. That's how you did your farming?
Yeah.
John, you must have decided at some point that you wanted to stop farming.
We were in drought a lot of time towards the end, and I was working at the forestry to supplement the income. And at work one day, I prolapsed unloading heavy pine seedlings, and I prolapsed the disc in my back, excessive pain. I put up with it and put up, and it got worse and worse. And then the finish, I was put off, medically unfit for work. And I wake up one morning and go into tears.
Mm.
I couldn't do anything. It was absolutely unbelievable, the feeling of being unwanted, unable to do anything, and this pain. And I got a rural counsellor out, and we went through everything. And at that time, I was 65. And she said, "You're entitled to an education grant of $3,000. And I said, "What the hell are they going to teach me at 65? Mm. And she said, "You'll think of something." And I thought of this cell grazing course, and that was up at Armidale, and it was $3,000 for the course. So I went up there, and that was one of the best things I'd ever done. There was 45 of us there, and everyone was switched on. You'd never seen anyone that was keen. We were there for a full week, and I came home with all these new ideas. And the government, with the $3,000, they refunded $2,000. So the next year, with that $2,000, I went back for the second session and advanced cell grazing. And I got the farm going with this cell grazing. And one of the neighbours, Laurie Wardman, he was an osteopath.
Oh, right.
And he worked on me once a week for 2.5 years. And I get round without pain. There's a lot of things I can't do. Mm. I'm handicapped with a lot of things, but I get round without pain. I go to a chiropractor every 6 weeks to have adjustment. Then when I sold the farm, I got the highest price ever there in that area. We sold in 2006. From 2007 on, you couldn't sell anything.
It's only good timing.
Yeah, and I come over here and bought a place, a small place.
Here in Oberon?
Yeah. I'm 85 now. I bought myself an electric push bike a bit over 12 months ago. I've got 1,900 kilometres up on it now. Next weekend we're going to Mudgee. There's 14 of us all riding around Mudgee. We've been down to Canberra, rode around Lake Billy Griffin.
Mm.
I keep active and keep the garden going. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful, John.
Yeah.
John, thank you very much for telling us your story. It's been fantastic to hear it. And I know that if I gave you the chance, you could keep talking.
Yeah. Yeah.
John, thank you very much for joining me today. Now I'd like to welcome Janina Knight to the program. Janina has lived in Oberon for 48 years. She was a nurse at the hospital here in Oberon and trained in Bathurst. She arrived in Australia when she was only 2 years old from the Ukraine. Janina has a fascinating story to tell, not just her life in the Ukraine, but those of her parents and an extended family. And like a lot of people who've come from that part of the world, it's not been easy to find everybody, having gone through two world wars and many other ups and downs. But Janina has written a book, and the book is called
The Three of Us in a Tin Trunk.
So why did you call it that?
Well, when we came over to Australia, it was Mum and Dad and me and a tin trunk. All their possessions.
Yeah, was it a big tin trunk?
No, not very big. Dad carried it by himself, of course, and everything they owned was in this tin trunk. So I just can't imagine leaving everything that I've got, put it into a tin trunk, and go clear across the world.
Yeah, it would be very difficult. But what inspired you to write a book?
Well, not having too much family history. Mum and Dad never talked about the past, their life growing up, nothing. So occasionally I'd speak to Mum and it'd be a question might have come up, might have talked about her parents. But usually there was very little discussion of life over there in Ukraine and Poland. She was 16 when she was taken from her parents, as was Dad. They were taken to Germany and put into camps where they helped to rebuild Germany post-war. and never ever went back. So her life really ended when she was 16 with the family.
Yeah, it would have been a very difficult time.
Oh, absolutely.
Very difficult. And it happened to so many people, so many other people in that part of the world. So is this the reason why you wanted to tell the story in a book?
Yes.
Had you been a writer? Had you written a book before?
Oh, gosh, no. I was a nurse, not a writer. And it sort of started when the girls left home, and I got four grandchildren, and I thought, they have to know a little bit about me. So I just started jotting down some notes and the things that I could remember. Mum was still alive when I actually started this book, so I used to ask her a few questions, and she'd occasionally just let me know whether she wanted to answer or not, and usually it was not. But a few things came out, so I just jotted things down, never thinking that it'd be put into a book, of course.
So how did you go to that step of turning all those notes into an actual book?
We had the U3A in Oberon, and so I thought I'd just go along to that and see how it'd go. Anyway, with my notes, I just started, and then there was a woman there, Inara Hawley, who compiled my book for me, said that she would help, and the notes on scraps of paper, little notes here and there, and it just all came together that way.
And you had lots of photos too. You've got a lot of photos in your book.
Yes, but they're the only photos that I've really got, because the family really didn't have a camera. It wasn't a priority to have a camera. So the photos I've got were treasures, really. And, they are treasures.
And the book, you've only just produced the book, haven't you?
Yes, a matter of weeks.
So it's still hot off the press.
Hot off the press. I only did five copies, and that's only for the grandchildren, of course, and one for me. I have a granddaughter who loved the idea of me writing a book, and she's skipped through it. She's eight.
Oh, really?
She skipped through a few pages and just said, "Oh, Nina, you really did this?" So that was really nice.
No, that's a joy. Now, let's go back to your parents' time in the Ukraine.
Okay.
Or their predecessors. Where did your family come from originally?
Well, Dad came from Poland and Mum from Ukraine. She lived in a village called Serenia. And we actually went and saw this village. They've got about 12 houses up a dirt road. They still actually use the water that comes out of a well. There was a man going down while we were there. A man went down to the well with a plastic bucket and got water out of this well. A lot of the houses were demolished, of course. My grandparents' house was demolished. So all that was standing was a gateway that my grandfather built, and it's still there. Like, that was unbelievable. And a little orchard is still there.
And how did they live? Were they farmers or...?
Well, my grandfather was a carpenter, and they weren't really farmers. They used to grow their own fruit and vegetables and store everything for the winter. It was amazing, you know, but that part of learning how it was unreal. They'd had cows and a few sheep and a horse, and their life was just life how everybody was there. It was just living.
Living in a village,
and these people are still there in this village. They have a little seat out the front of their fences, and every morning they'd meet each other, and they were doing this while we were there.
Yeah.
You know, things haven't changed. There's no shops there. There's nothing there. There's this few houses and a cemetery. And we went down to the cemetery, and all the wooden crosses are gone. Like, there's a tree where my grandfather and mother are buried, and there's nothing there, the tree. And my cousin said, "Well, this is where they lay." Yeah. And I said, "There's no markings." And he said, "No." He said, "They needed firewood, so they'd come down and got the firewood."
As priorities.
Yes, that's it.
Anything to keep warm.
Yes, anything to keep warm. So my grandfather made sleighs, and he was very good at his trade, and he was in demand. So they were quite well off. But unfortunately, when the Germans came, they just blasted their house and they had to move on. And they've always lived close to that area, like they lived in Poltava for a while, and now they're living in Vianetsa. My aunt is still there. She was only a child. She was only 2 years old when Mum was taken. Mm. So she didn't know her sister. And Grandmother could never accept that Mum would never have gone back. But my auntie looked so much like her mother. And when she died, she actually called my auntie Kutcher. She thought she'd come back.
Oh. Yeah, no, that's wonderful.
You can't you know, you just can't imagine what it would have been like for the families that the children were taken from. And most of them were children post-war, you know, it was just dreadful.
Which part of Germany was she taken to?
Well, I was born in Altenstadt. I don't know whether they were that far away from this town or this village, but they both worked on farms, separate farms, and they actually met at a dance.
Oh, right.
As they would have done. And then they sort of got together and, yeah. I was born in Altenstadt, and Mum and Dad then were still working on this one farm. Dad had come across to where my mother was, and they just lived together for a while. And then came the opportunity to move away after everything was sort of settled and the Americans came in, the English came in, and they chose to come to Australia.
Why did they pick Australia?
Well, it was the furthest country from where they were.
Yeah.
And no one would find them there. And Mum had to say that she was Polish to come across because she wouldn't have been able to get onto a passport to come across. So till the day she died, she was Polish, and I didn't know that. Things get lost in translation, you could say.
Indeed they do. Mm. Now, you have a number of other cousins and other relatives still in the Ukraine, don't
yes.
you?
Yes, I do. I have two cousins, Oksana and Oleg, and Oleg is married. He is the border control officer for the Ukraine, so he's got quite a prominent position there. They live in Kiev. Oleg and his wife have two daughters. And Oksana, she lives in Vinnytsia with my aunt and uncle, and she's a history professor at the university in Ukraine. And, you know, she only gets paid what a cleaner gets paid over there. You know, they say, how is it over there? Well, nothing much has changed.
Yeah.
They've just got a lot more people. You know, the war is still going on over there, really, isn't it? You only have to listen to the news, and it's still all happening. Yeah. I didn't think it was as bad as it is. You find these things out.
That's right. We never get to the bottom of the story ever.
No.
All we're relying on is news programs.
Oh, and half of it's falsified anyway, you know.
Now, you went over to the Ukraine after getting a very strange phone call, didn't you? Tell us the story about that.
Well, one evening, it was about 8:30 at night, just sitting around, and the phone rings, and this phone call said, oh, is this Yanina? And I said, yes, it is, and my blood just went quivery. And I thought, my God, my mother calls me Yanina.
Yes.
And I said, yes, it is. And she said, oh, I'm Elena, and I'm ringing from Moscow. We're a program that reunites families. And I said, oh, yes. And she said, would you be interested in meeting your family? And I said, well, the Red Cross had been trying to find my aunt after Mum died, and they tried for 4 years, and there was no success. They said, oh, it's so isolated, the communication over there is really poor, so we're sorry, we can't help. And I sent off a donation and thanked them, and that was it. And quite a few years later comes this phone call. It was March 2011, and Elena said, would you be interested in meeting this family? And I said, oh, absolutely. But thinking, oh, it may have been a bit of a ploy there, something else is going on. Anyway, it took nearly 12 months to go through all the process of, we had to get visas and passports, and oh my God, getting the visa was unbelievable. We had to go to Canberra 3 times to get a visa from the Ukrainian embassy, and it was just bits. But anyway, we hopped on a plane.
So this is all to be on part of a TV program.
A TV program, Wait For Me, in Moscow. And anyway, we got to Moscow. We had 3 days touring, and then we went to the studio. That was an experience, like this back of a shed. And they had a program in there, TV set up, and there were probably about 60 people in the audience, and they spoke Ukrainian. And, of course, I can't speak Ukrainian. I spoke Polish. And it's similar, but, you know, translation is different. But anyway, I could understand them. We got through the program okay. We met my mother's cousin, who I didn't know anything about. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this isn't my auntie, you know. Do I have to go somewhere else to meet her? It was my mother's cousin and her son and children, and daughter and a son. And then they said, oh, I said, oh, this is wonderful, you know, just meeting relatives there, because we came to Australia, had nobody here, no relations, just mum and dad and my two brothers and myself. And then they said, oh, but just one minute, there's more. And I said, oh, this is great. And my aunt came out, and my gosh, the resemblance of her and my mother were unbelievable.
And buckets of tears, no
buckets
doubt.
Buckets of tears. And, you know, it was just wonderful to have met them. My cousin, Oleg, couldn't come on because of his position in Ukraine. So we met him later. We had lunch and met him later on. And we just partied, drank lots of vodka and ate lots of salami and ham. And the food was amazing. It was just brilliant. So then we went to Kiev. We had some time there. We went to see Oksana and Auntie in Vinnytsia. And then we went to the village of Smila to see my mother's cousin. So we had time there with them. And just their culture and the food they ate, well, I still have here, all the salamis and brawn. And oh, it was just wonderful, just wonderful. Plenty of vodka. Plenty of vodka.
And how long were you over there for that TV program?
Well,
altogether?
We were there for 2 weeks. The program, it was a matter of minutes, and we were on and off the show. So we had 5 days in Moscow. We did a bit of touring around there, which was amazing. And then the rest of the time we spent with the family, which was just beautiful.
Yeah. And now that you're back, do you still keep in contact with them?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. We actually went over when the plane was bombed in Ukraine. But we couldn't get in. My cousin said, no, you can't come here, but we'll meet you in Cyprus.
Oh.
So they came over to Cyprus. He said, I may not be able to get across, but he said, I'll try. So we went across and met them in Cyprus and had just 2 weeks there, which was magnificent. Unfortunately, we couldn't get into Ukraine to see my aunt again, but we had time with them, which was beautiful, and Oleg did come across. They let him through for 2 weeks, but it was touch and go whether he would come or not. And then, for my 70th birthday last year, my husband and my two daughters brought out the cousins from Ukraine. Instead of having a party, they said, oh, well, what can we do? So they brought them across and they had 2 weeks with us, which was just brilliant.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you're still keeping in touch with them?
Oh, that's another thing. I thought, oh, correspondence is going to be dreadful because the letters still take such a long time to get over there. But we do keep in touch by email and FaceTime, and it's just so great. You know, Christmas time, birthdays, there's greetings all round. So it's just amazing. Really is
and
amazing.
And do you feel as if knowing that you have that extended family has changed your life? Or
oh, yes, it does. It does. The girls, my two daughters and the grandchildren have now got extended family, reason to tour, to go and visit, which they will do because they're just, the connection has been made.
And they've got a history now.
And they've got
their
history.
They didn't have before.
That's right. That's right. It's just awesome.
We've been listening to Janina Knight, who originally from the Ukraine with a fascinating story to tell, not only about the TV program that she was invited to out of the blue, but also from the history that she's been able to put together in her own book. Janina, thank you very much for joining the program.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Now I'd like to welcome Grace Cunningham to the program. Grace was born in Oberon 82 years ago and she's lived here ever since. Now your family has been here for a really long time too, haven't they?
They have.
Can we go back to your grandmother who you spent a lot of time with? What was she doing from your memory?
Well, she was a hard worker. I think they probably came here looking for work. In the summertime she and my grandfather would pick peas. But she was a wonderful cook and a lovely sewer.
And where did she come from originally? Was it, you had other family in Tumut and
Kurrawatha and Gundagai.
Gundagai.
They came from.
That was a long way to come.
Yeah, it was.
For work.
Yeah.
Was work really short at that time?
I think it must have been.
And whereabouts did she live in Oberon when she first came?
At Hazelgrove.
And that's where you were born too?
Yeah, we were born in Oberon, but she lived at Hazelgrove.
Now, your mother and father both worked around here, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
What was the kind of work that was available at that time?
Well, Dad mainly did actually worked at the Lithgow Small Arms Factory. And he used to drive down there. He'd go on Monday and come home Friday.
Oh, he stayed there over the week. Yep.
And then just other labouring work until he became a pea farmer.
Now, peas were all the go in Oberon.
They were. It was very big.
So the climate was exactly right for growing peas.
Just, you had to be careful of early frost and frost at the end of the season. But I can remember Dad would go around the pea paddock lighting fires to put smoke over the paddock so the frost wouldn't get the last of the peas.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good trick to learn.
Mm.
And how big did his pea farm get?
Very big. He grew peas at Burriga and also at Native Dog on the Condon family's property, which was huge.
Mm.
Acres and acres.
Yeah, look, I find it interesting, you know, that so many people were involved in growing peas. I wonder where they grow peas now.
Not so much. I think what happened, it was when the frozen peas, I think they were coming from New Zealand.
Oh, right.
And that was the end of the pea season, the peas in Oberon.
And nearly everybody in Oberon was involved in that, weren't they?
A lot of people were, yeah. It gave a lot of families work, you know, to pick peas.
And what about you? Did you have to do it as well?
No, I was bad at it.
Yeah.
My mother and father were both really good pea pickers.
Yeah.
But I was very slow.
Mm.
I only did it once.
Did you?
I ate more than I picked.
Oh, well, that's a very good strategy. The pea season here in Oberon would have attracted a lot of people.
A lot of itinerant workers. And there was families.
Mm.
And some had quite a few children. Husbands and wives and some of the old men.
Yeah.
And
lots of characters, I'm sure.
They really were. One old guy had a wooden leg. He used to pick for Dad.
Oh, yeah.
And he had the wooden leg stuck out the side of the
pea
vine. But Friday, they didn't pick Friday because there's no market, of course, Saturday, Sunday. So they'd have Friday off and they'd all come into town and they'd hit the pub.
Oh, is that right?
But they weren't violent. Like, there might have been a bit of a fisty fight among them sometimes, but they weren't violent people.
Yeah.
They're good people. The majority, they're all good people, really.
It was probably one of the few forms of entertainment.
Yes.
For the men, at least, yeah.
But the same people would come back year after year, like picking for my father.
Yeah, yep. Oh, well, they must have felt that they were treated right.
Yeah.
What was picking season? What month?
Well, the summer.
Oh, it was okay then.
Because
you couldn't be camping in winter.
No. And, like, they'd get frosted, you know. You couldn't do it in the frosty weather. They'd be getting sown during winter.
Yeah.
And then they'd come up and up and up and up. And once the pods got on there, like, if they got frosted, they'd get a white spot on them.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't sell them. But one Christmas, he got 84 shillings a bushel, and that was huge money. But that money had to last you till the money you got in the pea season had to last till you started the next season.
Yeah.
And you'd be nearly down to nothing.
Sure.
You know, you'd be really, really poor. We were really poor people, really.
Well, I don't imagine that many people in Oberon were all that flush.
No, people made over at the Meadows, the Jarrett family, you might have heard of them, Frank Jarrett. They were the more well-to-do people in the district, and they made their money out of rabbit skins.
Oh, right.
And you bend a piece of wire like that, and you put it onto the skin.
So you bend a piece of wire like a U-shape.
Yeah, like that, and you push the skin over it with the flesh side out, and that all dry.
Yeah.
And when they dried out, then you'd bring them into Ray Cunningham at the produce shop, and he would buy them and they'd be sent away to do whatever. The rabbits were a big thing.
Yeah, well, that's right. I was just going to say, not just Oberon.
Mm, they were a pest, but
if it weren't for the rabbits, we wouldn't have a Cobra hats.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Now, what kind of work did your mum do?
Well, other than the housework and working at home, but she was a really, really hard worker out in the paddock. She liked being out. And I can remember at the pea paddock at Burriga, and it was very, very long rows of peas, and you had to scuffle. Look, the scuffler was a piece of machinery. You held it by hand, but a horse dragged it.
Oh, gosh.
And that was to weed between the rows to get the weeds so they wouldn't be growing up in the peas, vines. Mm-hmm. And she would walk all day behind this horse, all day, up the row, down the row, back up the row. I don't know how she did it. When the pea season, she would pick peas all day.
Mm.
Had that boiling hot sun. She was the hardest worker. I couldn't do what she did. Yeah, she enjoyed doing that, and she could drive the tractor and, you know, do all the things. And yeah.
She could do everything.
Yeah, she could, really.
You know, I sort of think of that as being a typical country woman.
Yeah, well, she was.
Yeah, who could do everything that needed to be done.
Milk a cow. She'd have the bucket, and she'd have froth.
Yeah.
And I'd try, and I could get a wee little squirt.
Yeah.
Couldn't even milk the cow, but... Boy, could she milk a cow?
Mm. So that was your milk all the time?
Yeah, the milk didn't come in cartons back in those days, or bottles. Everybody had their cow.
Yeah.
Nan had a cow, we had a cow.
Mm. Now, tell me about where you went to school, Grace.
Well, I went to school at Hazelgrove. When I was there was about 21 students, and that went to year six. There wasn't a school bus at that time, so we did work that was sent to us from the department, and we did our own work in the Hazelgrove school. But then Philip Hogan started a school bus run, which was a truck.
Oh, yeah.
And he put the canvas over the back. And then we had car seats, and we sat on those, and he made a little ladder.
So he just bolted them inside the truck, did he?
I think they might have been loose. I don't think they bolted.
Nice bumpy ride.
And just a little ladder to climb up in the back of the truck. And I went to St Joseph's School, and after that I went to St Mary's College in Bathurst.
So the school in Hazelgrove, the building itself still actually exists.
Mm.
I know this because I live not far away.
Yeah.
And so I drive past it every day. But it looks tiny.
It does look tiny.
It's only about 3 by 4 metres or something.
Yeah, I can't even believe how tiny that it looks either.
Yeah.
But we had a weather shed there, and then, of course, the boys' and the girls' toilets. And
did you like going to school there?
I loved it.
Mm.
Yeah, I loved it.
And the friends you made at school, are they still people that you still...
some of them still live around here. Some of them moved away.
Yep.
Of course, some of them aren't with us anymore, but it was a good little community. Believe it or not, they used to have dances down there.
Did they?
Yeah.
Not in the school?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It's big. Got to be bigger than it looks from the road.
Must be like the TARDIS. Yeah. Was your school teacher tough or lenient or...?
He was very good. How would I describe him? He very fair. He was... always insisted on really good handwriting. I used to be a good handwriter once, and spelling and grammar, which I don't think kids are taught grammar anymore.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. I don't think they're taught spelling either, to be honest, because everybody's got a spell check on the computer.
Yeah, that's right.
So they don't have to bother.
No, he was good. We had an open fire for heating.
Did you?
Yeah.
And was it cold in winter?
Yeah, fairly cold. But I actually started school out at Balfour because Dad had peas out there. And Mr Ross, he was the teacher there, and then to Hazelgrove, so I had him in both schools. At Balfour, the school was up off the ground like that.
And so up above about a metre high.
Yeah, about a metre high. And the pine board floor, the knots fell out.
Oh, yeah.
And if you happen to be sitting over a knot in the middle of winter, it was cold. Freezing.
Yeah, I suppose. Did little creatures come up through the floorboards?
Never saw any, but I suppose they could have.
Yeah. Yeah, well, these are the kinds of buildings that everybody was used to in those days. Yeah. And so what was it like when you went to St Joe's?
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock being a bigger school. Anyway, we still got used to it.
So after St Joe's, you went to St Mary's in Bathurst. Was there a school bus?
I boarded.
Oh, you boarded, did you? Why did your parents send you to St Mary's to board?
I don't know. I suppose Mum thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
Better education.
Yeah. All right. And what kind of work was available in Oberon? when you finished school?
For girls, all the girls worked at the hospital, the Auburn District Hospital, employed quite a lot back in those days.
Yeah. And what can you remember about working there?
Well, one of the things was we had open fires. All the wards had open fires.
Mm.
And you'd have to go outside at night to the where the coke was. You know, that's like coal, but it's coke. You get shovel, scuttlefuls of that. And we had to keep the fires going all night and also keep the stove hot for the girl to come in to cook breakfast. So that was one of the things that we had to do, but just look after all the patients, which I love, really love.
And so then you started nursing there as well, didn't you? How did you get to be a nurse?
Well, my cousin was having her appendix out and they were short-staffed that day. So Dr. Roby called me into the theatre because he thought I would make a good nurse. And from then on I was nursing. And I really did love it.
How long did you keep nursing?
Well, actually, what happened, you had to do night work on your own, and I was nervous at night. And, like, for a medical, you could call one of the sisters. But I had to go outside at night to where I'm telling you to get this coke. And also, you would never know who might turn up at the door. So I couldn't cope with night work. One of the other girls preferred to do night work because she was on a farm and she could do her farm work. And so for quite a long time, she did my night duty.
Yeah.
But Matron Arnold decided that I should be doing my night duty. And I did it for a while, but I couldn't cope with it by myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I went home then.
Well, it was a terrific career for a town the size of Oberon back then. You were lucky to have a career.
Yeah.
That was more
than
we
were very lucky, really.
Yeah.
Because other than that, like, you'd... some of the girls got work in shops.
And what occupies you now, Grace?
My grandchildren and my needlework, my quilting. That's my big interest.
Now, I know there's a really active needlework group here in Oberon, isn't there?
There is, very. I haven't got an exact date on it, but we've been doing it for at least 40 years, the ones who started it.
And today we're sitting in Grace's kitchen. And just over my shoulder, there's a lovely quilt on the couch that you've obviously made.
Yeah.
How do you decide what kinds of colours and patterns to use?
Oh, you just get ideas from books or classes that you've been to. But I've done lots of different kind of needlework, like ribbon embroidery and things like that, as well as patchwork.
We've been listening to Grace Cunningham. Grace, as we've heard, was born in Oberon 82 years ago, has lived a very full life and has an extensive family and a lot of memories of what it was like to grow up in the 1940s and ever after.
I'm Susan Lacey and thank you very much for joining me today. Join me again next time. Bye for now.